3,879 days. That is how long it's been since the words, "The Federal Reserve cut interest rates today," have been said on this program. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, 31 July today, or as we like to call it around here, the day everything changed. Okay, not really. I mean, the Federal Reserve did cut interest rates today a quarter of a percentage point, just like everybody had been guessing. First cut in more than 10 years, 3,700-something days. But still, it's a lousy quarter point. Come on.
So again, I don't think asking about a quarter point is really the right question.
Oh, all right. You tell me then, Fed Chairman Jay Powell, what the right way to look at this is.
I think you have to look back over the course of the year and see the committee moving away from rate increases to a neutral posture to now a rate cut.
Okay.
You see an economy which is actually performing pretty well. Growth in the first half of this year is about the same as it was in all of 18, and actually a little better than our forecast for growth at the end of 2019.
All right, fair enough. But look, downsides?
We also feel like weak global growth and trade tensions are having an effect on the U.S. economy.
Well, yeah, but you all know what you're doing, right?
Thing is, there isn't a lot of experience in responding to global trade tensions.
Oh.
So it's something that we haven't faced before and that we're learning by doing. And it's not exactly the same as watching global growth, where you see growth weakening, you see central banks and governments responding with fiscal policy, and you see growth strengthening, you see a business cycle. Yet with trade tensions, which do seem to be having a significant effect on financial market conditions and on the economy, they evolve in a different way.
A translation here, if I might. The Trump administration's trade policies are sui generis, as economists like to say, one of a kind, and nobody is really sure what to do about them. Okay. Back to Chair Powell to wrap it up.
Thank you. I'm happy to take your questions.
Us too, as it happens. A lot of you emailed or tweeted at us because we asked you to, with questions about the Fed and what we all knew it was going to do today. Daniel Richards from Las Vegas, Nevada, spoke for many of you when he asked, basically, why he should care. We got Ann Owen, a Fed economist, once upon a time, now a professor of economics at Hamilton College. We got her on the phone to explain.
Well, the average American should care for a couple of reasons. The interest rates affect many different aspects of the economy that actually affect individuals directly. One thing that it will affect is it will affect the cost of loans, borrowing costs, and especially mortgage rates, consumer loan rates like auto loans and credit card loans. You should see a response in those rates directly in response to the Fed rate cut. So they should care about borrowing costs, but they should also care more broadly on the impact on the economy. It's going to affect the borrowing costs of businesses also. And when their costs are lowered, then they're more likely to hire people and pay them more. So there are a number of different ways that this could affect the average American.
J.D. Anson is from Miami. He got a bit more technical. Wants to know about the Fed's inflation target, 2% a year, as we remind you from time to time. How, asks Mr. Anson, did they pick that number?
So the Fed has articulated a longer-term goal of 2% for inflation. And that's slightly different than actually having a target, which means that they have some level of commitment to achieving it. They're basically just telling people that this is what we're trying to achieve. And the reality is there is nothing magic about the 2% number. The most important thing about it is that the Fed consistently says that it's going to be 2% because that's what creates stability in the inflation rate.
The catch, of course, is the Fed consistently says it wants 2%. It consistently undershoots, as we also tell you from time to time. Stability that Ann Owen was talking about was not a feature of the stock market today. After playing possum all week waiting to see what the Fed was going to do, traders decided they weren't really wild about it at all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all the talking we do about what Chair Powell says in those press conferences, we don't get too many peeks into what actually happens in the big conference room in the Fed building on Constitution Avenue in Washington when the Fed's talking about this stuff. Daniel Tarullo was in and out of that room for 8 years as a Fed governor. He teaches at Harvard Law School now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
First things first, sir, what do you think of the news of the day?
Well, it's obviously what everybody expected in terms of the action, and I do think it's also what everybody expected in terms of people having some difficulty understanding exactly how the Fed is looking at next steps.
Which is what the chairman spent the bulk of his press conference explaining, right?
Yeah, it's obviously a difficult communications challenge, and I think what he tried to do was to indicate that the move from increase to neutrality to today a 25 basis point cut was all part of one reaction to a set of increasing risks in the economy. But as you could tell by the reaction of some of the reporters, that's not an easy message to convey.
Well, darn reporters. What are you going to do with them? Which gets me to this, actually. One of the reasons we wanted to get you on the phone today is because you were in the room the last time the Federal Open Market Committee changed gears, as it were. We had gone from a very low zero interest rate policy from 2008 to 2015, and then you were in the room when, under Chair Yellen, y'all started to tick things up. And what I want to get a sense of, first of all, is the conversation preceding that announcement, because you were not initially in favor of beginning a rate increasing cycle in 2015.
No, that's right. I would say, Kai, I think the odds are quite high that there wasn't a whole lot of discussion yesterday and today about this move itself. Huh. I suspect not only the action, but the allocation of votes has been known by the chairman for a week or more. So I suspect the conversation today was more about how are we going to communicate what we're doing, what might lead us to move further in the future, what may not lead us to move further in the future, and perhaps some of the ancillary risks associated with the move that were not discussed at the press conference.
Yeah, so Chair Powell, speaking of the press conference, Chair Powell obviously gets the big money. He has to go out there, relatively speaking. He has to go out there and face the questions. And we in the business press sometimes say Jay Powell raised interest rates today, but it's important to note that he's got to bring along a bunch of people.
That's absolutely right. And I think one of the things about the post-crisis Fed, which has been underappreciated, ironically, to a greater extent by Fed watchers than by the general public, is the degree to which the Fed chair really needs to act a bit more like the chair of an econ department than the boss of a company, which is to say he or she has a bunch of independent-minded, smart people who need to be brought along to something resembling a consensus. And it actually takes a lot of work. Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen both spent an enormous amount of time on the phone and in people's offices, and I suspect Jay does as well.
Last thing, and then I'll let you go, sir. Without asking you to, you know, crystal ball the future, it sure sounded, and I know you were listening to the chairman's press conference, as were the rest of us, sure sounded like this is one and done. You?
I don't know that it's one and done, but they certainly didn't want to communicate any lean towards another increase. I think, Kai, if you look at the minimal changes in today's FOMC statement from the last meetings, I think that's an indication that they're trying not to signal much of anything in any direction. The one thing Chair Powell said at the press conference, which I think supports your inference, is when he talked about a mid-cycle adjustment. And he was trying to downplay the notions that this is the beginning of a trend.
Right. Daniel Tarullo was on the Federal Reserve for 8 years, 2009 to 2017, now at Harvard Law School. Mr. Tarullo, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
Took them a while, but the Democratic debate last night eventually did get around to the economy. I, personally, would have started there to begin with. But the first chunk of questions the candidates got were about health care, more specifically something called Medicare for All. You are all but certain to hear more about it tonight in round two, and again and again and again and again over the next 15 months. The thing is, as with most buzzwords the politicians throw around, lots is left unsaid. The short version is that Medicare for All is a single-payer system, one in which all Americans would be covered by an expanded version of Medicare. The longer version comes courtesy of Marketplace's Andy Euler.
There was a moment in last night's debate that highlighted the different approaches to Medicare for All. Congressman Tim Ryan challenged Senator Bernie Sanders over Sanders' proposal, which is backed by Senator Elizabeth Warren and others, that would all but do away with private insurance.
Medicare for All is comprehensive. It covers all health care needs for senior citizens. It will finally include dental care, hearing aids, and eyeglasses.
But you don't know.
Second of all.
You don't know that,
second
Bernie.
Of all.
We'll come to you in a second,
I do know. I wrote the damn bill.
The bill that Sanders wrote, that's kind of the purest version of Medicare for All, under which everybody would move to a single payer, the government. Michelle Mello at Stanford Law School says that means we wouldn't have employer-sponsored insurance.
This is a pure public system. It is tax funded, so you don't pay premiums every month, and you have low or no copayments and deductibles. Basically, the only thing you're going to be paying for your health care comes out of taxes.
Some Democratic candidates, like Beto O'Rourke and Senator Amy Klobuchar, are proposing less aggressive Medicare for All plans. Larry Levitt at the Kaiser Family Foundation says these proposals
would not only preserve private health insurance plans within Medicare, but it would also preserve the employer-based health insurance system.
In other words, people can still choose private insurance, but Medicare would cover many more Americans. Bottom line, every Medicare for All plan represents a big expansion of government's role in the healthcare system. They're all expensive, and the purest version is the costliest, says Rice University health economist Vivian Ho.
And I don't care who's in charge of Congress. They're never going to improve a budget increase that large.
Sanders and his backers argue that any tax increase to pay for his plan would be less than an average family currently pays in premiums, copayments, and deductibles. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It was a mess. You know, unemployment was skyrocketing. The banking system was on death's door.
2008, so far away, yet so very, very close. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, you had to figure the Wawa's, right? Dow Industrial's down 333 points today, 478 at the low, by the by, 1.2% at the closing bell, 26,864. The NASDAQ down 98 points. Also 1.2% there, 81.75. The S&P 500 down 32 points, just more than 1%, 29.80. Apple's strong earnings report from yesterday afternoon continuing to push its stock higher today. The stock rose more than 2%. Another winner today on the board, pharmaceutical firm Amgen, even though its quarterly revenue fell. Its newer drugs are seeing a lot of demand. Amgen's ticker gained 5.7% today. Garmin's wearables, those fitness watches, and other athletic-related devices continue to show strong growth. That company stock banked just over 2.5% today. Bigger than expected quarterly loss, though, and fewer paid subscribers. Did a number on Spotify, down 0.1% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. One of, if not the, big threats that Chair Powell sees to the American economy, besides trade, is what's going on in the rest of the world. Slower growth in China, for sure, but also Japan and Germany. Lots of places in Europe, actually. So central banks elsewhere have been cutting interest rates, cutting so much that rates are actually negative. So Evelyn Orley from Cardiff, California, wanted to know whether interest rates might go negative here as well. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
The idea that you'd have to pay a bank money for the privilege of depositing your money there honestly sounds insane.
Negative interest rates as a concept is really something that makes your head spin.
That's Torsten Slok, chief economist at Deutsche Bank. He says a quarter of government and corporate bonds around the world have negative rates. Timothy Dewey is an economics professor at the University of Oregon.
The idea is you would get consumers, instead of parking their money at the bank, would have to park their money into other assets.
Central banks use negative rates when there's a recession or when their economies are just weak. Japan and Europe come to mind. But here in the U.S., the economy is fine, says Greg McBride at Bankrate.
The U.S. economy is definitely the best house in a bad neighborhood.
McBride says interest rates are still pretty low, though. And if a recession hits and the Fed has to cut rates further,
the Fed only has so much room they can maneuver with interest rates before they get down to zero.
Still, he says interest rates would have to go far below zero to start affecting regular savers. Even in Europe, it's mostly big institutional investors paying to deposit money. But Torsten Slok says if rates keep falling below zero, people might withdraw their money from the banks. And why wouldn't you?
Well, why should I have my money in the bank with you when I instead can pull it all out and put it in cash?
So keeping your money under a mattress isn't always crazy when your bank account costs you. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
There's practically a whole generation in this economy that doesn't remember the last time the Federal Reserve cut interest rates. December of 2008, a very different, a very scary time, which is not, repeat, not where we are now. But for those who've perhaps forgotten or maybe never really registered it, what it was like the last time the Fed made money cheaper and why they had to, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has this refresher.
The last time the Fed started to cut rates, and the Fed cuts rates, by the way, to stimulate the economy, the last time they started doing that, there were some flashing warning signs on the economy's dashboard. The check engine light was on.
The housing market had started to implode. There had been what seemed like a shock going through financial markets.
Seth Carpenter is chief economist at UBS and was at the Fed at the time. The Fed spent the next year and change hammering down interest rates as the economic situation went from bad to worse. The engine was on fire. The last time the Fed cut rates was December of 2008.
Last time it was, you know, patently obvious what they should do. They had to cut rates. It was a mess. You know, unemployment was skyrocketing. The banking system was on death's door.
Mark Zandi is chief economist at Moody's Analytics.
You know, there was no ambiguity about it. This go around, you know, there's a debate.
There's a debate because in a lot of ways, the economy today is pretty good. Why mess with it? The unemployment rate is close to a 50-year low. Stocks are near a record high. GDP growth rose to 2.7 last quarter. Two committee members voted today to not cut rates.
I at least think that on the merits, they shouldn't cut.
Doug Holtz-Eakin is president of the American Action Forum. So why is the Fed trying to stimulate the economy?
The old wisdom is that recoveries don't die of old age. They die of policy mistakes. They don't want to be the ones who make that mistake.
In other words, better safe than sorry. Business spending in the U.S. is down. Business confidence is down. Inflation is a bit below where the Fed wants. On top of that, there are a lot of things that could go really wrong. Austin Goolsbee is professor of economics at the Booth School of Business.
You've got the IMF downgrading how fast the world is growing, but also things like the potential trade war to escalate, the potential hard Brexit in the UK, if China had a popping bubble, stuff like that.
There's something else. There's kind of a dark cloud looming over the Fed right now. It's the fact that if we did get a full-blown recession in the near future, the Fed wouldn't have the same firepower to fight it as it used to.
Fed is in a bit of a dilemma when it comes to the how much room do they have to cut.
Before the first rate cut in 2007, interest rates were as high as 6.25%. The Fed had a lot of room to cut. Before today, interest rates were just at around 2.5%. There's a lot less room to maneuver in. With the recession, interest rates stayed at zero for 7 years. That was 7 years of the Fed not being able to use its most important tool. UBS's Seth Carpenter.
How constraining that can be on monetary policy, I think that absolutely is now deep in their psyche, and they're moving to be preemptive.
If we get another recession, it could well be harder to get us out of it. The Fed is saying best to do everything you can to avoid one altogether and keep the expansion going. And if the Fed gets it right, and the expansion does continue, rates could rise again, and the Fed would have its old firepower back. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
If you you've been in a shopping mall in this country at any time in the past 40-something years, you have seen a Foot Locker store, right? It's been a staple, catering to sports-minded Americans. But with the impending doom that faces malls across this country, the company is getting creative as it tries to survive the sneaker wars. Elizabeth Segrin is a senior staff writer for Fast Company, most recently about Foot Locker. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Do me a favor and give us the lay of the land in sort of retail sneakerage, if you will, and what Foot Locker's trying to deal with here.
Well, over the last 30 years, a bunch of interesting things happened. Sneakers became much more than a functional pair of shoes, right? That they were much more than just something that you would wear to the gym. It became kind of a marker of identity and status and a form of self-expression to young people. You know, over the last 10 years, people are increasingly buying their sneakers online and at secondhand stores so that they can get, you know, old vintage models. And so in this new landscape, Foot Locker, which was this, you know, bastion of the old way of buying sneakers, is no longer that relevant anymore.
How is it trying to adapt and get a slice of, you know, the sneakerhead future, if you will?
It is a really fascinating strategy, in my opinion. So Foot Locker is now morphing into an entirely new kind of company. It's becoming a little bit of like a VC firm, an investment company that's going out and making investments in interesting companies related to what it does. So most recently, it invested $100 million in GOAT, which is a sneaker resale marketplace. Yeah. You know, it's investing in other sort of growing businesses that will accumulate a lot of data, you know, about youth culture and what's going on in the sneaker world so that it can fuel this other thing that it's doing, which is it's trying to become kind of a consulting company for brands that are interested in understanding youth culture. So those are the two parts of its new business.
Right. But the question then is all of that enough to save Foot Locker from the terrible state now of mall-based retail in America?
Well, that's the big question. In my opinion, this is a wild card strategy, right? It's basically coming up with this totally radical new approach. These investments, I mean, they could pan out, right? I mean, these are small companies that have the potential to be enormous in a couple of years. I think that the sneaker wars, I mean, the sneaker industry is going to be a $95 billion industry in the next 5 years. I think all the companies out there in this space don't really know how they're going to win these wars. So it kind of makes sense for a brand like Foot Locker to just kind of throw spaghetti against the wall and see what sticks, you know?
Can we back up for a minute to the data part of it? What data is Foot Locker going to get from these investments in the marketplaces and all of those things?
So that's really fascinating. Another resale brand called StockX recently was valued at $1 billion. So there's this huge marketplace where people are trading sneakers as if they're stocks. And the brands themselves, like Nike and Adidas, don't have access to any information about what's happening there. That those sneakers are now beyond the brand, right? They're in this totally other marketplace. So there's a lot of data that a brand like Foot Locker, through its investment in GOAT, has access to. So it can understand what sneakers are coming and going, what's hot, what's not, that kind of thing.
All right. So are you just a reporter who is really into her story, or are you a sneakerhead? And if so, what are you wearing on your feet right now?
I'm not a sneakerhead, but I am really fascinated in this industry because sneakers are this like enormous part of how we express ourselves today. And to me, I think that that's one of the most fascinating things about this, right? Who are you? You know, just look at your shoes.
Elizabeth Segrin is a senior staff writer at Fast Company. Elizabeth, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out, Chair Jay Powell's response today to questions about certain Trumpian tweets about the central bank and how it's doing its job.
We never take into account political considerations. There's no place in our discussions for that. We also don't conduct monetary policy in order to prove our independence. We conduct monetary policy in order to move as close as possible to our statutory goals, and that's what we're always going to do. We're always going to use our tools that way, and then at the end, we'll live with the results.
You get the impression he's sick and tired of answering those questions, right? But right on schedule came the tweet this afternoon, the President of the United States talking about the Fed chairman he appointed, quote, as usual, Powell let us down, end of quote. I don't know. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial's off 333 points today after Wall Street decided a quarter-point cut and a healthy economy was not enough, 1.2% to the downside. The NASDAQ off 98 points, about 1.2% there as well. S&P 500 down 32 points, just over 1% on that particular index. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.